issue that, especially in developed worlds, I mean, the underdeveloped worlds, most people aren't on drugs, you know.
That's not really a choice, because in the open loop system, all of that water reintroduced into the rivers, absorbed by the fish and wildlife, and then re-ingested by us anyway. So we're not choosing whether or not to re-ingest our pharmaceuticals. We're just deciding whether to do it locally or.
Yeah, and the comment is that we're already seeing the effects of some of these pharmaceuticals. I mean, they're, as far as I know, they're in the rivers and streams, and they're getting into the fish. But hopefully we can deal with them on site by keeping them separate from all the other problems. Now you've got them at least contained in the urine, right? I'm not aware of any treatment of the pharmaceuticals it's like a lot of sewer treatment plants are not treating for the nutrients, the nitrogen. I mean, what they're trying to do is primary treatment. See, Victoria is doing screening, right? They screen out the scraps, and then there's primary treatment, which a septic tank does, which is takes out the solids and the tissues, and then there's secondary treatment, which is what most U.S. plants, probably Canadian, do, which is knocking down the strength of the waste by usually pumping oxygen in to get the microbes to break it down. And the next level would be tertiary treatment, which you're addressing the nutrients. But here again, that's the process is what the problem is. They're looking at the nutrients as the problem, and now let's spend more money to take the nutrients out. And like Jason said, that's just wasted resources. So if you go back to what we're trying to do is we want to keep the nutrients in our cycle, because we need them to do the things we will need to do in the future. So it's where you get kind of like, let's eliminate the problem by doing something different, and then we're not dealing with the issue at the end of the pipe. So we're getting rid of the pipes so we don't have that issue. So in Europe, there's kind of a, like Jason would like this, there's kind of a design competition going on among countries is what is the best urine separation toilet system look like and how does it work? So you got the Sweden version over there. Actually, there's, to get into little details, there's kind of three general ways these toilets are working. One is they don't use any water, right? And the one on the Sweden side is pretty close to that, where the number two goes directly into a composting unit under the floor. The middle one is from the GTZ in Germany, where they've developed with a manufacturer there the front bowl and the second bowl, and they both have the front bowl has a little bit of water just to clean the bowl, take the urine down. The second one is the number two is regularly flushed down, and it goes out to the city sewer. So in their building right now, they're only taking the number one out and collecting it in the garage parking area into some tanks. And then this one over here has a flush in the number one and then a composting in the number two. And they waterless urinals, pretty common in Germany. A lot of the newer buildings they went to had waterless urinals. They got a little different style than some of ours. So here's what they're doing in a lot of their countries that they're helping. Some of the developing countries, their typical waste management were pit toilet buildings, where the urine and the number two, one and two, would go into a hole. Well, a lot of the liquids would then flow down into the groundwater, and then their well, which is just down the way, was they're getting contaminations from the way they've been doing things. So they've been showing them just a few of these tricks we're talking about, separating these sources out. Now they've got resources with all the nutrients in it, and they've come up with all kind of creative ways to now use that to grow food and different sorts of products, fish. Here's nutrient, the hydroponic type of gardening that they're doing by recycling. So I can see this on site. This could be done at a residential level, block, city block level, neighborhood level, where we're keeping those nutrients. And what's interesting about this too is that some of these nutrients are coming from off-site, right? You go out and eat. So now you're bringing the nutrients back on site, so it's kind of like a free reuse of that material, right? So eat outside, you know, bring it back. And then you get more nutrients that you need to grow the stuff that you can eat on site. This is the GTZ building. This is the tour I got when I was there. This is a newer building. It's over 6 floors, I believe. All the bathrooms in the main center area. Men's and women's have the urine diversion toilet. Of course, the men's have the waterless urinals, too. All those get piped, separated. The urine goes down into the parking garage. You have 3 tanks, pretty large tanks. They're probably about 5,000 gallons each. And as one tank fills, it starts filling the second. They close that one off. They have a truck that pulls up every few months, fills their tank, and then they take it out into their pilot fields to use that urine. And so they're stuck with some transportation, but that was because this was built in an existing facility. The number two here just goes to the city sewer. Here's this very simple. This is what it could look like if you're in a residence. The bathroom could pretty much look like any other bathroom. But if you look inside the toilet, you got a urine separation bowl with the number two going to a composting unit, and all that material then is used back on site. And we could talk more about composting toilets, but there are really good composting toilets in the United States that we've used. And when the product comes out of some of these systems, and by the way, it's processing. And what I tell people that are interested in this, it may be 3 years before you get a 5-gallon bucket of compost out of your composting, because most human waste is water. And most of the compost that you take out is the sawdust and the compost material that you put into it to start it. And so you, when you're talking about recycling number two, we're not talking about tons of material, even though you may perceive it that. And then the number one is can be handled because already fairly sterile material. And that's just what the Germans have done is, you know, because of transportation, they want to limit the amount of water that gets in the urine so you're not transporting more. They found that as it sits for, I think they let it sit in a tank for a couple months, which takes care of any sterilization, or, you know, it just becomes a safe. Anyway, I'll stop on that. Go to their website and go visit them. These are some projects we've done over the years. I just want to show you these because this is before there was a living building, but this is a little composting toilet, public restroom we did. 500 watts of power generated on the roof to run all the little lights and systems we put in there. This has a composting system in the lower. It was kind of a daylight building. When you get into efficient systems, we've got the 2 tablespoon per flush foam flush toilet. The waste slides down into the composting unit. 1,000 flushes. All we need is, and we're collecting rainwater, so we only need a 100-gallon tank to get us 1,000 gallons of flushes there, and it's a gravity flow system. Right. So then you've got waterless urinals. See, very simple. The gray water from the sink. That's one thing when you use composting toilets is you don't have any black water to deal with. All you have is gray water. And the gray water, it flowed down into the lower area. We have a tiny, tiny little pump that periodically pumps the gray water back to a planter box on the roof, and we have zero discharge of any of that gray water because we size our gray water planter boxes to use all the gray water. There's some transpiration kind of calculations you can do. I think you have a question over there. You're just thinking really hard. Okay. So that's the general thing. So that's one of the pieces. Like if you go to a no water conveyance for your waste, all you have left is gray water. So right from the beginning, you've taken out one of the biggest issues is dealing with black water. So there's the toilet. You know, when we got this toilet, we got it actually shipped in from Japan. Clivus now in the United States, Clivus Multrum Composting Toilets actually market this, so you can buy these in the States now. It's interesting. If you look in the bottom, there's a 3-inch hole. It's just straight down. So at first glance, it looks like a, you know, pretty conventional. As one of our goals in this project was to build something that the general public could go, you know, I could maybe do that, you know.
Is somebody looking at trying to capture methane?
They do a lot of methane. The question is about capturing methane from the compost. But in third world countries, there's quite a few. I didn't put one of the diagrams in there, but China has done that for years. I mean, they create methane in their composting area under a lot of their houses, and that methane is what they use to cook with. So.
I know she had a propane, you know, heater in there, and
yeah.
That's kind of the one thing that was missing from a completely.
Right. And the other piece was we had to jump through hoops through the permitting, and we gave up using the water to drink, right? So we do have a potable well supply. But, you know, when you get so far and they've accepted so much, at some point you go, okay, well, we got, you know, 80% of what we wanted. We'll stop. And we at some point we have to, like, try to build this, too. So, yeah.
There will be water or a liquid accumulation in the storage. What do you do with it?
In the composting? This one here, what you find, actually, in the Phoenix composting toilet system that we use down here is my favorite. It has a if there's excess liquids, I mean, composting takes a lot of water, so a lot of the water evaporates. And any that makes it to the bottom of the unit, because these units are about 7 feet tall, there's a little pump in there that's running off the solar power that puts that water back on the top of the compost pile. So we do have an overflow that could go out to this. This all has an overflow to a septic field. As far as I know, it's never overflowed. They do have an evaporation system, too, that if that becomes a concern. A lot of these Phoenix systems are out in remote national parks and things like that. They deliver a building. It's got PV on it. It's got the whole building and the systems already put into it, and they just set it out there, and people use that when they're hiking or in the area. So the liquids. One thing about composting toilets, we've got... This does not have urine separation, but the urine does have a lot of salts in it. If we were to separate out the urine, we'd actually have a healthier compost, and you can throw red worms and you could throw other compostable materials in there that if this was in a house, and they actually have a better composting system too if you actually separated the urine out from this. But this one commingled the number one and number two, which they're designed for. But in some of the examples in Sweden, they're composting. Number two goes to the compost, and the urine goes to a tank that they use, right? So they've separated out in their composting toilets the number one stream. This is a very simple one we did. This is back 10 years ago, one of our, we call them marketing projects. You guys probably do these once in a while where you get like minimal amount of money to just try to do the right thing. And if you get a client, and in the United States, sometimes there's less regulations on the tribal lands. So we've been able to do some of our projects, sustainable designs on tribal lands where you can work with, and the American Indian nations love natural systems. I don't know if you'd be surprised with that, but when you talk to them about this stuff, they're like, hey, why aren't we doing this all over? But this is a rainwater harvesting, 2 3,000-gallon tanks, two people that live here. We got our water efficiency down to each person 25 gallons per day. So it's designed for 50 gallons per day demand. So the 6,000 gallons of water with the catchment area provides all of their water, drinking, showering. And the other thing we do, which is part of what a living building would look like, we don't have any black water because of the they have composting toilets. So all the gray water, I don't have a picture of it, simply flows by gravity outside. This is state approved. I mean, there are permitting processes. You can get some of this done if you really look at their codes. But we designed a gray water, an alternative gray water septic system where we could take the gray water into a constructed wetland bed subsurface. And so the gray water gets used for irrigating their landscape in their gray water bed. And so if you think of this, this is as close as you can get to an ideal system because the water that's coming down hits the roof. You temporarily delay it going into the ground by holding part of it. You use it in the building, and then it just goes back. The excess, you know, maybe less 10% that might evaporate from your use. But it all goes back into the environment where it would have if the building wasn't there. And you can see, I mean, this is a homeowner's construction, right? I mean, they were able to build this whole thing themselves. All it has is a couple of cartridge filters, 20 micron, 5 micron, and then we run it through an ultraviolet light to disinfect it. I can tell you, in Hawaii, Kentucky, and Ohio, very few people disinfect. I mean, there's a whole story even going on there, but people that have been doing this for generations, the water goes into their cistern, they don't touch that water. They don't know what happens to it in there, but they just know whatever's going on in there, and I know it's life, treats it, and that's what they've been using for generations. They just don't touch their tanks. The newer kind of engineered systems, oh, every year you should flush it, chlorinate it, you know, clean it out. But historically, if you get a system in equilibrium and it's working, it seems to do great. And they can be gravity flow systems too, no energy. This one I've always liked. Go ahead.
Are you required to test these periodically? Like, municipalities or government bodies basically say you have to take so many samples?
Yeah. Yeah. The question is, in these rainwater systems, do you have to test them? This one here is on tribal land. As far as I know, they've never had to test it. Now, that's part of what we think is one of the pieces, and this is of information, is researching and documenting how systems are performing. A couple of the presentations I heard this last fall from Australia, the couple guys that have their PhDs were there to talk about all the sampling and testing they've been doing on their systems. I can tell you in Hawaii that have, I've heard, over 60,000 rainwater systems, because basically everybody lives off of that. The water that hits the ground goes down a mile through the lava. There's no regulations on designing, installing. I got a license there, and we did a project there recently, but when you get your building permit, there's not even a question like, do you have water supply? You know, it's just like they assume you're going to do water, and there's not even any regulations for it, really. And they've had some problems because there are some viruses and stuff that can get in the water, but other places that I know, like in Hawaii, Ohio, Texas, other places, I'm not aware that there's any regulatory, right? So it's kind of like where it is happening, it's kind of almost outside of the regulatory circle. Now, if we want to bring it in, there may be pros and cons to that, because everything, places that that's been happening, they've been, you know, pretty much doing well without the regulatory control. But there are health departments that are educating people and telling them. I mean, you want to hear a story, an example. I mean, this lady that I know over there in Hilo, she goes around and checks. She gets a call from this lady, oh, my water tastes terrible. Can you come out and take a look at it? So they have a swimming pool with a tarp kind of thrown over it, and the tarp it kind of blew over. And she looks inside of it, and there's like a dead rat in there, right? That's the water. That's why the flavor isn't very good. So there is issues with people not having, you know, going back to being educated enough to know that there's certain things should be built. So that's kind of extreme on what happens when there is no, because they might have inherited that from the previous owner and never really trained what was going on over there, right? DK, this is a great one. I know this project Bob Birkenbeil worked on with BNIM Architects. This is right about 5 miles south of here. And these are the examples that we've tried to use over the years to show people this can be done even at a commercial scale. This building on campus, four floors, all the toilets are composting toilets. There's a shaft that goes all the way to the basement. And on the left, it's not a very good picture because it's dark down there, but there's four Clivus Multrum toilet units. There's no black water from this building, so the only thing left is gray water. And they irrigate their landscape strip along the front. It's actually designed as a subsurface flow constructed wetland. And they do also collect rainwater to use for other. But that, I mean, there's no discharge of waste into the city sewer, even though they have a pipe there. This was done about 10 years ago. So here's the living machine. Now, this is ideas of a combination of natural systems, but there's also a mechanical component of this. There are aeration and other pump systems in here. These have been great at educating people of how nature works and how if you work with nature, you can get a very high level of treatment. But they are energy intensive. But they could work at a proper scale of a neighborhood. On this project that we did, this project here is Islandwood. It's a educational kind of school that has 150 kids a week come out there. Treats all the wastewater from the buildings. The water goes back for toilet flush and irrigation. But it's good for education, but there is a, you know, energy demand on these systems. I was going to say something else, but I forgot. Oh, okay, I know what I was going to say. So if we were to had the opportunity to take this project to the living building standard, what you see is by recycling your wastewater on site, we dropped our potable water demand by 80%. So now that tiny little piece that's left over could have easily been rainwater harvesting, right? Because now we got it down to a point where we can efficiently, cost-effectively build a little cistern to give us the rest of the demand. I didn't think of that when I did that, you know, 5 years ago, but that's the living building scenario. That's the amount of water you'd have to have for potable. This now is a large-scale project we're working on. It's in the environmental impact statement process. It's in the state. It's a large peninsula. There's a marina on the left. This whole area over here. About 300 acres total project site. It's a dysfunctioning RV camp that's basically going broke. Go ahead.
Do you know where the building at PPC, how it stands up in terms of the water use and because the rainwater supply, all its water?
Yeah, the question was about the C.K. Choi building. I don't have that data, but wouldn't be surprised if they have it. It wouldn't be hard to go back to their water use records because they're buying water. I'm sure it's getting metered. And you could find out, typically on commercial office buildings, most of the water that's being used is your toilets, flushing toilets, because people are coming there to work, drinking a little water. But so the little bit of water demand there, yeah, their cisterns probably could have been used for rainwater too. But that's another example of how they've already pushed that project pretty far to break some of the codes. But that would be another example of a project that would have worked. Because that 80% really is that toilet flush. And so whether or not you compost it or recycle it, the composting just takes a lot less energy than treating your water. So this project, Hood Canal, is one of the most environmentally sensitive bodies of water in the Puget Sound. When this project, actually it's a Canadian developer that's going to turn this into a resort. There's over 900 units designed. There's an 18-hole golf course. There's a marina. There's restaurants. And when they started into the project, the agencies, the Department of Health, Department of Ecology said, well, so many words, they said, well, you can develop there as long as you have no discharge of stormwater into the Sound, as long as you have no discharge of any treated wastewater into the Sound. So after going through about three engineers, and they couldn't find any way of doing that, somehow they found us. And we developed this into a closed-loop system that, here's the golf course plan and the condos. Storage of water, all the runoff and water, there's two kettles. That's when the glaciers come through and big ice cubes melt later. But we got natural storage ponds ready to go. So we're going to separate it out, our water supplies. Now this shows an example of how these are high-end units. I mean, most of the people coming to this resort are going to be, over 50% are going to come outside of the United States or Canada. I mean, these are luxury resort, you know. So this isn't, you know, hippies out in the wood building straw bale houses. So this is all the way out, right? And so we're down to a typical, all these are, this is going to look as normal as any resort, like your hotel room here. But by using efficient systems, we could get the water per person down to 32. Right? They're going to use natural plantings. They're going to reuse the water for some of the irrigation, like the golf course. So here we go, 32 gallons per day per person compared to 150 per day. So 2.2 people per unit, so we're designing for 70 gallons per day. Typical book value for a three-bedroom septic system is 360. I mean, that's what the code is telling us to do right now. So you can see the breakdown. You'll see here, this is our potable water. You see there's no toilets there because we're going to flush the toilets with our reclaimed water. And if I had my laser here, I'd do better with this. But all the water we're going to use on this site is rainwater. We're going to take the clean rainwater from the roofs and other clean surfaces, and that's going to be put into our storage ponds that will be used for our potable water supply. We will treat that water, and that gets back to drinking water standards. The wastewater that comes out will be treated to reclaimed water standard. Toilet water, and then we pipe back into the buildings for toilet flush. The excess water throughout the year ends up in the storage pond. We size the storage pond. This is our golf course irrigation, you know, to use the water. So this is the water balance that we did on this. As you size your systems, your storage pond for your irrigation demands stores all the water when it rains throughout the winter. The idea is that all that water gets used up through the summer as you're irrigating, so it's empty starting back into the fall when the rains hit. We actually have, and this is an acre feet, we still have a surplus of water that's going to be used for recharging the aquifer, even though we're not taken out of the aquifer. You can see almost half of the water on this site, 1,131 acre feet, hits the site. 500 of it gets evaporated from plants and things. So the remaining water, it's used, reused, a lot of it going over and out. There's a lot of codes and regulations we had to jump through to get to here, but the one thing, and this is going back to, you know, how do you pull something off like this in a regulatory environment, is we invited all the different departments at the state level, and within a Department of Ecology, there's the water rights people, there's the stormwater people, there's the water reuse people, I mean, and then we have the Department of Health, different departments within that. We got them all on the table. The owner did a presentation why this would be a good thing for the economy in this area where people don't have jobs. I went through the presentation of this, and it was, they ask a few questions at the end, they're very quiet, and then finally, like, so what do you guys think of this? And the owner's kind of like, you know, if you don't like it, we'll go away. But, you know, here's an opportunity to do something creative. We could fix up their marina, which is contaminated, right? So there's this opportunity there to do something good for the environment. And they're all like, well, this really sounds interesting and good. And within a few weeks, they all sent letters saying, this looks like we could work with this. They have to get their water rights. They'll have to do a lot of things to get there. But we're not drawing any water out of the aquifer. We do have a well on site that we could use as a backup. But so this is a scaled living building example. So the question would be, can we put wind generators and PV out there to power the whole site? That piece isn't part of this project, but that's where you'd have to go then. Because this is a gray field that's already been developed, sitting there, not doing well to the environment. So possibilities.